Come fly with me, come fly with me, come fly with me, come fly with me underneath the sea, breathing life to me.
Matrix of life resounds with me.
Come join the convergence. Meet me at the stargate now. We're gathering together, brothers, sisters. Come to the convergence now.
What does it mean to be gifted and talented, quote unquote? I was IQ tested when I was, I think, around 4 or 5. I had started reading when I was 3 and was in a special gifted and talented class in the first grade, in a pullout program where I took a bus to another school to be with a group of other kids who had high IQs in the 3rd grade, and in the 5th grade was in another special classroom. We know now that those IQ tested tests are biased. And for certain, I do have a certain ability to perform well within the norm. And what I mean by that is that I could accomplish the tasks, academic tasks of normative public school, the worksheets and the standardized tests, etc. And part of that was, I think, I have the ability to, I think really that my greatest gift comes from empathy. My ability to feel into others' feelings, sensations, and experience. And on a standardized test or a multiple choice test, even in that case, what it feels like is that I have the ability to sense the answer that the person who created the test wants the correct answer to be. Or also a sense of what is the pattern of answers. So if there's A, B, C, D answers on a multiple choice test, a series of multiple choice answers, then on most standardized tests, they will vary the correct answer to be A or B or C or D. So that's the best way I can describe that ability to take tests like that. And the same would be true even for a short answer. It's not the smart of knowing lots of things. It's the smart of knowing what the person who's giving the test wants to hear. I did thrive in these kinds of environments as they were set up in my youth, because the difference in the gifted and talented classroom was that activities were more individualized, customized, and self-motivated. So we each had a series of activities, learning experiences that we were working on a weekly or a monthly basis. And then we had the ability to decide how to use our own time. So we could spend more or less time on certain activities. And the learning activities that we were doing were not the kind of rote learning activities like I was describing, like read something and answer this multiple choice questionnaire worksheet. Which, I mean, why were they not using those techniques in the regular classroom? In fact, by the time I was in the fourth grade, I was refusing to say the Pledge of Allegiance in class. We were still reciting the Pledge of Allegiance out loud, standing and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance out loud when I was in elementary school. And I wouldn't have been able to articulate this at the time that I was 9 years old, but it was an understanding about the role of public school in socialization, and understanding that in our society that going to public school, that only a portion of that experience is really about learning or building intellectual or emotional intelligence. It's really about training people to be
a part of the society in which they were born. In our case, training us to be good citizens, to fall into line, and to follow the path that we were given of taking a job after high school or going to college and taking a job and spending the majority of our life in a job making money for somebody else. So that, and that idea of sitting in a, you know, sitting in a chair and doing work, which prepares you to sit in an office or a store or whatever. So that type of critical thinking and ability to look outside my experience, I think, was something that I just was born with, and probably promoted by my parents, who were, you know, young people of the 60s generation, who questioned authority, questioned the way our society was being run, with the Vietnam War in particular, the civil rights movements, the feminist movement, and opposition to the Vietnam War. As I was born in 1969 in Manhattan, New York City, while my dad was in medical school, I often lament that my parents really wasted an opportunity living in Manhattan in 1967, 68, 69, which was like the heyday of art and culture and music in New York City, or one of the heydays. And I read Patti Smith's book about her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe and living in New York at that time, and other biographies, John Lennon also. And yeah, just for me, it feels like an amazing time. And my parents definitely were not participating in that. But so I was born into a particular time. I was born with certain genetic predilection from both my parents' sides and my own reincarnational history. And so there is a certain, you know, each of us as children is praised, and we feel valued for certain qualities that we have. And while it probably was always my unusual insight that was valued, it was more focused on a kind of intellectual, insight, rather than this, what we would now call an emotional intelligence. And I suppose an
unusual for the history of human culture as we know it, was that as someone who was born a girl, and always considered myself a girl, that I felt really valued for my intellectual abilities, for being smart academically. And I know this was in big part for my mom. It was a response to the way that she was raised. So within one generation, there were huge leaps in the opportunities that women had in American culture. So when my mom was growing up in a small town in East Texas, in a Southern Baptist community, she was very interested in academic pursuits. And yet the message that she got consistently was, well, you know, you're just going to get married and have children. So why do we need to invest in you and your academic pursuits? And despite that, my mom was able to, and you know, go to college. She must have had somebody in her life who was telling her that that was possible. But then, so at her, in her generation, you know, the opportunities for women, you know, outside of the home, outside of the being a mother, a wife and a mother, which are valuable professions in themselves, were like teacher, nurse. And in fact, after her second year of college, when she met my father, she ended up taking what was at the time one of the ways for women to adventure into the world. She became a stewardess. Just for 2 years, I think she was a stewardess before she and my dad got married, and she followed him around in his medical training as a doctor. But going back to this idea of being gifted and talented, I think part of it is also my mom's response, like I said, to her upbringing and wanting to be recognized for her mind. And so promoting those things in me as her child. And so, yeah, being labeled as somebody with a high IQ, who is gifted and talented, who who's smart, like, it definitely has an effect on one. And so while I do recognize that I do have some special skills that are somewhat unusual in my experience in the world, in being with other people, I would say that the biggest one comes from this sense of empathy. In third grade, when I was part of this pullout program, so once a week, one other girl and I, a girl who would become one of my best friends in my life, would leave our classroom in the morning and wait for a bus and go across town, not very far, 10 or 15 minutes, and were part of this group of kids who had all been designated gifted and talented. And I mean, what I remember is like, oh, we pulled me out of the classroom where we're doing worksheets, et cetera. And then you bus me across town so that we can bake cookies. Because instead of doing a math worksheet where we're using a recipe and, you know, I think there was probably some math involved in terms of here's the original recipe and now we want to make it, we want to double the recipe or something like that. So those were the sort of differences in the learning style, which I'm like, why were they not using that with everybody? Because, like I said, the system actually isn't trying to promote innovation and people who think is outside the box. Now, I happened to, when I was in first grade, moved to Davis, California, which is a university town. And so the public schools in that town were actually some of the best public schools in the entire state of California. And many of the teachers who taught, particularly at the junior high and high school level, were almost college level teachers. So they did actually really promote critical thinking and having a worldview in a way that you may have not received at other public schools. But at the same time, there was that focus on normalization, let's say, in the behavior that was being rewarded. And then in the fifth grade, I was offered and decided to go to a somewhat new program, which was a classroom of, it was fifth and sixth grader combined, and it was a classroom, a gifted and talented classroom, and it was at another school. And so my mom did leave it up to me, I believe, to choose whether I would leave my current school and my friends and go to this new classroom or not. Actually, I didn't go in the fifth grade. I went in the sixth grade. And so the classroom, my same friend that I'd mentioned before was in that classroom. And it was a combination of fifth and sixth grade. So there were students who were working on different things and different levels. And we did things like the assignments that I remember, we built a house scale, and we wrote books. We learned to type. Actually, that was one of the most useful things that I got out of that classroom, is that we learned to type. Of course, it was on manual computer. Manual typewriters. But learning to type actually was a revelation for me, because for the first time, I could get words down on the page as quickly as I could think, or almost as quickly as I could think. And so I loved typing. In fact, I still to this day, I've never really liked handwriting because it feels so slow as compared to the speed of my thoughts. And certainly set me up for later using a computer, because I had been typing for a long time. And also when I was in my 20s, I was able to get temp work, working as a secretary, because of my typing abilities. So that was nice to have that kind of backup way of making money. And so interestingly, though, I think that I'm not really somebody who wants to dedicate their life to strictly intellectual academic pursuit, which is maybe what especially when you get into junior high and high school and you get into the AP, you know, advanced placement courses, are kind of focused on, you know, very soon as you move into junior high and high school, then it's all about getting into the right college. And honestly, I feel like I did say this to my parents recently. They were asking me about whether I enjoyed the college that I went to. And starting in junior high and high school, I started doing more art, mostly drawing at that time. And I think there was an inner artist in me that was searching for expression. I think also my writing, you know, later in life, my writing is definitely part of my artistic expression. And so when I applied to schools, I did apply to some schools who were art schools, so to speak. And my parents didn't really, I don't think it's that they didn't have an appreciation for being an artist, but they had this mentality of, you know, you're not going to be able to make a living as an artist, and that's important to be able to make a living. So, and I don't think I had the confidence really to commit my life to that. The school that I actually do have a minor in studio art, and I took a lot of art classes in college, and I can remember because my professors in art were working artists as well in Los Angeles, and my painting teacher in particular was very influential. And because we didn't really have a large art department at my school, because it wasn't a school known for art, I took very many courses with the same professor, and she made it very clear what it meant to be an artist. And I understood that there was, you know, the same level of commitment that you would make to anything else. That was a daily practice of art,
you know, of making art. And that it wasn't all, you know, that, you know, most of your days were going to be this practice. And in the pursuit of something, some sort of expression, and that, or greatness, that most days weren't going to be like, you weren't going to be making spectacular art every day. And so you weren't, I guess, you know, now that I think about it, that going back to this idea of being labeled gifted and talented, then there's this sort of expectation that everything that you do is going to be wonderful and praised. And in the pursuit of art, that most of the time, and maybe never, are you going to get that kind of feedback. Because true art is actually not about pleasing somebody else. And going back to my empathetic abilities, it is a gift and also a curse to be able to feel and perceive what other people are feeling and what they need in any given moment, because it wipes out one's own feelings about what one needs themselves, what I needed myself. And at least now in my life, 52 years later, I am, in terms of being an artist and artistic expression, that I feel like artistic expression. Well, I was just listening to an interview with Patti Smith, who in my mind is a true artist. And so that the artist is exploring something. And it's about the process of exploring whatever that is. It could be the meaning of life. It could be who am I? It could be exploring a certain medium like clay or paint or color or light. And looking to offer a different perspective on things that hasn't been offered before. To express one's own unique way of seeing the world in a certain medium. Song, music, dance. Painting, sculpture. And so this part of myself that was always trying to meet the needs of other people was at odds with that sort of pure artistic expression. And I can remember that feeling and the moment when I was in college of thinking, I don't think I have it in me to be a professional artist. Even though there's a part of me that did want that. And so interestingly, the sort of gifted and talented path in elementary school actually was promoting that sort of our artistic expression and innovation and thinking outside the box. And yet, once I got into junior high and high school and got on that college bound AP kind of path, then it was more about just performance in order to get to that next step. And as I described, I was able to intuit the way to perform on those kind of standardized tests and things like that. Now, like I said, it's been shown that those tests are absolutely biased. And so they just happen to be biased in my favor. So am I smart, or do I have an ability to play the tests? I think the latter is probably more true. And so I ended up studying my major in college was political science. Actually, I started in international relations. I have always had a fascination with different cultures. And with, I want to say humans, I've always had a fascination with psychology and sociology and culture and language. And I think part of this is about when one looks across culture and sees differences in cultures, then it also leads to what are the underlying similarities, right? So some of these things that we're brought up to believe are normative, it turns out are not. They're cultural constructs. So I think that probably the earliest experience I had of this is I grew up in California in very progressive communities. And in the summertime, I would go and visit my grandparents, my mom's parents, in, like I described, East Texas. So, and it was like being in another culture. I can remember when I'd go there, a small town, and everywhere we would go, you know, we'd go to a restaurant or clothing store or something, and my grandparents would, whoever the waitress or the shop clerk, they would tell this person my whole, like, who I was and my whole history. Like, they would stop and have a conversation and tell the person my whole history, and or people would say, like, where are you from? Because they could tell I wasn't from there because they said I had an accent. And I was like, well, I don't have an accent. You have an accent. And the racial disparities that I experience in Texas. Well, I came from a mostly white community. There was definitely this, you know, the progressive value of non-discrimination. And in the South, in Texas at that time, there was still a huge racial disparity between Black and white. And I have a memory of being in the back seat of my grandparents' car going to church on a Sunday morning, which was also another culture to me, because I grew up agnostic, not going to church. And so being in a very religious environment was also like another culture to me. But I can remember my grandparents proudly telling me about, you know, we're going to their new church, that their church community built. They raised $1 million to build this new church. And as they're talking about, you know, raising all this money to build this church, we're passing by what looked like shacks to me. And I'm riding in this air-conditioned car in, you know, summer Texas weather, where it's 100 degrees and almost 100% humidity. It's stiflingly hot outside. And I'm riding in this air-conditioned car talking about how they raised $1 million to build this church. And looking out the window, I'm seeing shacks that I know that Black people who serve people like my grandparents are living in. And I can just remember feeling that disconnect in that moment of, wow, they don't understand, you know, what this means, you know, to, like, why would you spend all that money on a big church where you're saying your message is that you're such loving, caring Christian people, but yet you're letting all these people right next door to you suffer? And that kind of empathy, now called emotional intelligence, was not something that was really recognized or valued. At least when I was a child. Although I would say that my parents did value my insight, the insights that I had into personal relationships. And I was, our family psychologist in a big way. My parents' relationship was not an easy one, although they are still together now. It was 55 years later. They have a special connection, but I wouldn't say it's an easy connection. And both of my parents individually would come to me for advice on their marriage. And they also would come to me for advice on how to deal with my brother, who was a somewhat difficult child.
And so I think in retrospect, being in that position was a burden to me. And also, like I mentioned, I was so focused on pleasing other people and helping other people with their own emotional needs that it's like my needs just weren't completely erased. And now when I look back at those years between, of let's say, public school, elementary, junior high, high school, it's almost like I have no self, no identity of my own in some way. And perhaps that's what the artist that was trying to emerge, that was my sense of self that was trying to find herself. And I wouldn't say that she actually started to emerge until I, to truly emerge, until I moved to Japan after college and had what in the Zen practice they would call one of those Satori moments of, shortly after arriving in Japan, I was dropped off at an apartment that the school I was working for was renting to me for low cost, and Japanese style apartment. So it was an empty room. You would take the bed, it was a futon, you would take it out of the closet and put it on the floor in the main room to sleep. But sitting in an empty room alone in the middle of a country where I knew no one, I did not speak the language, and asking, who am I? And realizing that I could become anything I wanted, because I didn't have cultural context of the culture I grew up in. I didn't have family or community context. And so there was a liberation, a freedom of, oh, I can be whoever I want to be. And so the story will continue next time.